I'm Jack Beatty. This is The Connection. George W. Bush may have trouble speaking and thinking coherently, but he is not stupid. He got what he stood for through the formidable barrier of his incapacity. Against abortion rights, for tax cuts for the wealthy, missile defense, drilling in the Arctic wilderness, privatizing Social Security, and the rest. These positions, plus what the talking heads called his likability compared to Eddie Haskell Gore, plus his promise to keep his pants on in the Oval Office, were enough for a near majority to vote for him. Mark Crispin Miller's new book, The Bush Dyslexicon, is not about the issues. Miller fills roughly 200 of his 280 pages with Bush's flapdoodle, which he pans often brilliantly for clues to the inner Bush. Miller's subtitle is Observations on a National Disorder, and that is where TV and American democracy come in. Connection listeners, how do you read Bush's manglings? Is too much made of his assault on lucidity, or not enough? Are his stumblings the mark of his populism or of his contempt for the people? And why don't the TV gas bags ever ask such questions? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or join us online at theconnection.org. I'm joined from a studio in New York by Mark Crispin Miller, author of The Bush Dyslexicon, Observations on a National Disorder, and professor of media ecology at New York University, where he also directs the Project on Media Ownership. Mark, welcome Jack. To The Connection. It's been too long since we've talked.
It's great to hear your voice again.
Mark, before we hear from you, let's hear from George W. himself.
You saw the president yesterday. I thought he was very forward-leaning, as they say in diplomatic nuanced circles.
Mark, Bush may have a severe form of dyslexia that makes words, grammar, syntax, even thought difficult for him. However, you see a kind of politics in Bush speak. You call him an anti-Lincoln, one who, instead of learning eagerly in humble circumstances, learned almost nothing at the finest institutions in the land. Then you add, when he comments on how many hands he's shaked or frets that quotas vulcanized society, he is, of course, flaunting not his costly education, but his disdain for it, much as some feckless prince with a crowd of beggars watching from the street might take a few bites from the feast laid out before him, then let the servants throw the rest away. Your imagery is aristocratic. Bush's speech, in your reading, reveals him not only as anti-Lincoln, but as anti-democratic. Can you explain?
I'm taking issue with the successful spin of Bush's mangled syntax, etc. The spin that would have us believe that Bush's tendency to talk that way is actually a sign of his kinship with the common man. This strikes me as the opposite of the truth. First of all, the common man doesn't actually talk that way. And to say that he does, I think, is actually a kind of an elitist point to make. But more importantly, it's my view that Bush is as far from an average Joe as a fellow could possibly be. This guy went to Phillips Andover and to Yale and to Harvard Business School. He went to the most exclusive and the costliest institutions of learning in the United States. And by all reports, he got into these schools not on the basis of his academic achievement, but through family pull. He himself was surprised to have gotten into Yale, for example. Well, for him to have gone through these schools with their splendid curricular offerings and their first-rate instruction, and then to open his mouth and say, for example, will the highways on the internet become more few, that doesn't strike me as an expression of averageness. That strikes me as a slap in the face to all those, indeed, average people who would have given anything to go to schools like that, and who would have made the most of it had they gone to schools like that. But on the contrary, in Bush's case, I would argue that his rather brazen misuse of language demonstrates how blithely he has squandered a tremendous gift that was his by birth.
Yes, and that his by birth is so important. He is a kind of political prince, after all, isn't he?
Yes, he is. The Bush family seems to be reluctant to use or even to countenance the word dynasty. George Bush Sr. has frequently dismissed the notion that he has founded a political dynasty. But as I point out in the Bush Dyslexicon, the Kennedy dynasty has always obsessed the Bush clan. They've always been quite conscious of the Kennedy paradigm. George Bush Sr. boasted of his own sons years and years ago, saying, "Just wait till I get my Bush boys out there." He was talking competitively about mm-hmm. about the Kennedys. So I think that we do indeed have the scion of a very powerful political family, and I can't emphasize strongly enough to your listeners, Jack, just how wealthy and powerful the Bush family is. It's true that Al Gore also came from a very wealthy family, but there's no comparison between the Bushes and the Gores. The Bush family boasts the Queen of England as a distant cousin. They're really highly connected.
I should say so. You know, this aristocratic vein in Bush, which you really see in his speech, it comes out sometimes, perhaps unconsciously, in his speech. For example, he's speaking of Social Security. He says, "There's not going to be enough people in the system to take advantage of people like me." I mean, that's an extraordinary statement, as if to say, it's the kind of thing you'd expect a rich man to say, "They're going to take advantage of me."
That's right.
Highly impolitic, but this is... This anti-democratic feeling in this sort of figure of the common man, to me, this was the revelation of his speech as you analyze it.
Oh, well, I'm glad to hear you say that. It's true that there are passages in the Bush Dyslexicon that fairly take your breath away because of the obviousness of their class view of life. And I'm glad you brought that up for another reason. I actually think it's a mistake simply to laugh off all that Bush says, all the mistaken things that he says. And indeed, I wrote the Bush Dyslexicon in part to take issue with the huge, with the rising trend of satirists, both in print and on TV, who would make mock of Bush's every mistake, encouraging a lot of other Americans to feel superior to him just for the sake of a cheap and I would say saleable chuckle. I don't actually think that many of the mistakes he makes are that big a deal, although they're often very funny. What's more important to me is the fact that he does not always speak unclearly. The distinction I draw in the Bush Dyslexicon, and I think this is the crucial one, is between those things that Bush has said when he is confident of his subject and confident of his audience, and when he's speaking pretty much from the heart. I draw a distinction between that category of speech on the one hand and those things that Bush says when he's trying to sound a note of compassion or magnanimity, when he's trying to sound a higher note. That is when he tends to sound most laughably incoherent.
That's when he puts food on your family.
Precisely. I know how hard it is for you to put food on your family. That got a lot of laughs when he said it campaigning in New Hampshire last year. But the laughter was a mistake because it tended to distract people from the motivation for that misstatement. He has trouble saying things like, "I know how hard it is for you to put food on your family table," I believe. He has that kind of difficulty because the fact is that he does not know how hard it is for people to put food on their family table, and he doesn't care how hard it is for people to put food on their family table. A good example of Bush speaking very lucidly came in the second debate with Al Gore, when he talked with a sudden startling clarity about the fate that he said awaited the murderers of James Byrd in Texas. I reproduce it in the Bush Dyslexicon. He talks about how the three men were going to be put to death. And he said it not only with a kind of frightening leer of happy anticipation. It was a look on his face of such pleasure that he was even asked about it in the next debate. But he also said it with unwonted clarity. He said it with absolutely unexceptionable lucidity. There was nothing wrong with mm-hmm. his grammar at that point. Mm-hmm. A few minutes later, however, when he started groping to explain how the Columbine tragedy demonstrates our need to find a way to build a kinder, gentler culture. That's when his syntax, his grammar just went completely to pieces. So what I'm talking about here is a kind of inadvertent truthfulness mm-hmm. in Bush. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He is not a very good liar. He is like his father in this way. Mm-hmm. There's a certain odd transparency mm-hmm. to his speech, which you don't find in someone like Dan Quayle, who is more of a clown, who tends to say stupid things all the time, and who doesn't have Bush's basic shrewdness. My biggest problem, let me just say this very quickly, mm-hmm. my biggest problem with the tendency to laugh him off mm-hmm. is that it encourages us to underestimate him or to misunderestimate him, as
right.
he puts it.
Right.
Whereas in Quayle's case, that wasn't
that
so.
That wasn't so. You write, television's daily revelation of his absolute unfitness was or should have been a killer. How come it wasn't?
Well, I argue in the Bush Dyslexicon that there was a really radical discrepancy between what the medium showed us and what the TV institution told us. There's an important distinction to be made, in other words, between the medium per se, just television, which tends to have a kind of merciless, tends to expose people mercilessly, many people. It tends to work on them like an X-ray machine does. There was a discrepancy between what the medium showed us about George W. Bush and what the talking heads would say about him, would discuss about him. There was a tendency to talk around his weak performance in the debates, to shore him up, to say, well, he did better than expected. He was really the beneficiary of what he has liked to call the bigotry of soft expectations. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But it didn't only relate to his awkwardness on camera. Of course, it extended even to the media's failure to talk about his own record in Texas, his own right-wing connections inside the Republican Party. No one that I can recall ever brought up the whole impeachment imbroglio or talked about his links with the primary players in that whole episode. So he was treated with, I think, a really striking forbearance. Well, that's a very good – that's the $64,000 question.
I mean, Gore, for example, I mean, partisans of Gore say that he was mauled basically by the press, that the reporters didn't like him, and that indeed he wasn't very likable, whereas Bush, as we know from the pontificate, Sam Cokie and company, Bush is likable.
Yeah, that tends to become a self-fulfilling description, like likability, that he's very likable. In fact, Bush is a very thin-skinned person. Extremely irascible and vindictive and with a long memory. And this sometimes flashes forth. Indeed, I argue in the Bush Dyslexicon that as was the case with Richard Nixon, so is it the case often with George W. Bush that you can tend to see him smoldering. But indeed, the talking heads bought the Bush-Cheney team's line that this guy was likable and therefore he was likable.
Connection listeners, are you liking what you hear from George W. Bush? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. This is The Connection. I'm Jack Beatty.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Coming up in this...
I'm Jack Beatty, and this is the Dyslexicon Connection. 1-800-423-8255 is the number to call to join the conversation. 1-800-423-TALK. My guest this hour is Mark Crispin Miller, professor of media ecology at New York University and the author of the Bush Dyslexicon, Observations on a National Disorder. Connection listeners, are you laughing or wincing at Bush? Howard is wincing. Howard, you're on the line. Hello.
Good morning, Jack. Your comments, those of Professor Miller, putting down Bush and explaining how his verbal fumblings inadvertently indicate what his true views are, struck me as dangerous. I'll get to that in a minute. What you've done, both of you, I think, have done is seized on what you think is the truth without giving enough consideration to alternatives. I don't like Bush or any of his policies one bit, and like both of you, I'm suspicious and or dubious of everything about him. But I think that when you're trying to understand some phenomenon, it's important to consider alternatives, and especially important to consider the simplest alternatives first, and secondarily, of course, to construct your ideas so as to allow falsifiability.
Well, what's the alternative?
Well, for example, here, the simplest alternative is that Bush is just not a particularly literate or articulate man. There are some people like that. Another very plausible alternative explanation seems to me that maybe his campaign advisors have discovered that certain people are captivated by his verbal clumsiness and believe it makes him somehow a more genuine figure.
And therefore, it's kind of a tactic.
Exactly.
Yeah. Of course, President Eisenhower famously would maunder on as a tactic, as a way of sort of putting the, as he said, I'll just confuse the boys.
With Bush, it might well be a tactic for a different reason, not necessarily to confuse, but to endear.
Mm-hmm. Mark Miller?
Well, with all due respect, I don't actually think that those are more simple explanations. The first one is faulty on its face because, as I just made clear, and I think as I make clear throughout the Bush dyslexicon, he is not always inarticulate. He is sometimes strikingly articulate. There was a moment very early in his term, it was actually before the inauguration, when he held that little education forum, which was aired on C-SPAN. It was modeled on the Clinton Economic Forum from early in his presidency. And there was Bush without a script, with a small group of supporters in the education field with whom he felt comfortable. Bush has obviously thought a great deal, for him anyway, about education. And he did a fine job. There was nothing wrong with what he said. He tended to get a little bit antsy when people's remarks went on too long. He couldn't keep it going very well. But he was not inarticulate then. He was not inarticulate when he debated Gary Morrow in the governor's race in Texas the second time around. He was fine. So that's really not going to apply here. The second suggestion that this is a tactic doesn't seem to me to have been worth the candle. Some of the things that Bush says have, I suppose, been endearing to the kinds of people who would find broken English a sign of commonness. But many of the things that he said by accident have earned him ridicule. And some of the things that he has said have even made people kind of uneasy, both here and abroad. The tactic, I agree with Howard that there is a tactical dimension to this, but it's interesting that it came into play after the fact. And the tactical move that the Bush team made was to begin to spin Bush as a kind of, they use the old ploy of self-effacing humor, which all modern politicians use. Mm-hmm. They've really gone into for this in a big way since Ronald Reagan. Bush began several months after he started to be routinely ridiculed for his faulty speech. He began to make jokes about it at his own expense, highly scripted, very clever jokes. This was the kind of thing he would do at the Gridiron Club, was the kind of thing he would do at the Al Smith dinner. There are a number of examples of this in the Bush dyslexicon, and it was very effective. So I wouldn't deny that there is a tactical basis to this, but I do insist that most of the mistakes that Bush makes off the cuff are genuine mistakes. Mm-hmm. And I really don't – I would simply urge Howard to give the book a chance because the sheer preponderance of the evidence – and I like to think the care that I take in making distinctions between different kinds of mistakes should certainly clear me from the charge of engaging in a kind of reckless over-speculation about this guy's speech.
Give you a quick example of a case in which I think you're jumping to a conclusion. You said a moment ago, you cited his comment that Social Security is not going to be able to take advantage of people like him. The phrase take advantage of can be understood two ways. It can be understood as to rip off or to exploit in a negative way, or it can be used in the sense of, well, listen, I'm offering you these resources, and why aren't you taking advantage of them?
Oh.
Yes. Well, that's very charitable.
That's a very charitable reading there.
But all I can say again, Howard, is that that one example that Jack quoted from the book comes from a list of similar statements that he has made on economic issues, which, it had taken in the aggregate, clearly demonstrate that the guy's views on economics are wholly in keeping with his entire life history, which is a life history of ease and privilege, a history with barely a single example that we know of his ever demonstrating any concern about the have-nots in our society. Mm-hmm. This is someone who coasted through the 60s blithely indifferent to all of the issues that racked the campuses and so on back then. He wasn't hostile to those things. He was just annoyed by them at times when they inconvenienced him.
Sure.
So, believe me, the case that I make about Bush based on his language is fairly well rooted in my own study of his biography.
Sure, sure. Howard, thank you very much. We're joined on the line by Todd Lindbergh, former editorial page editor of The Washington Times, now a fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. Todd Lindbergh, Mark Miller faults the media for treating Bush's gaffes as exactly that and nothing more. What do you say to that?
Well, I think it's a kind of longer story than that. I think there's a lot of interest to what Mark said, frankly, and I think that the examples that he quotes in the Bush dyslexicon, in addition to being rather amusing, which they certainly are indeed revealing. But what I'm not sure about and what I find difficult to parse is the idea that somehow the media have been negligent in their duty in reporting what is on Bush's mind. I think there's a tension in Mark's book between the idea that Bush is a moron and the idea that Bush is secretly a genius who is trying to rule the world. And I think that tension is, in the end, kind of unresolved. And I would submit that you really can't have it both ways. If he is indeed, as you guys have been describing him this morning, utterly inept, you're left with the question of how did he get where he is? And you know there are conventional answers to that question: connections, family, father, all the rest of it, sign of the dynasty, etc. But I don't think those are adequate explanations. You know, at some point, the guy in the suit in front of the microphone is the person to whom people must respond and either vote for or not vote for. And Bush got to 49 point whatever the heck it was, or 48 point whatever the heck it was percent of the vote. The electorate divided evenly as between him and Al Gore. And I don't think that can be entirely attributed to a lack of information or an insufficiency in the reporting, the quality of the reporting that was addressed to him.
Mark Miller?
I appreciate your praise for my book, Todd. But let me hasten to clarify something. I don't think that Bush is a moron. I do think that he has serious intellectual limitations. I think that he is quite ignorant. I think he's proudly ignorant. I think he is...
He's blithely ignorant.
Blithely ignorant. I think he's illiterate. And as I demonstrate in a particular chapter in the book, he has a problem with abstract reasoning. But all that having been said, I don't think he's a moron. I never say anywhere in the book that he's a moron. And in fact, I say on the contrary that it is a mistake to see him as a moron. He has a certain political shrewdness. I thought that Bill Clinton's assessment of Bush, which he gave to the New York Times a couple months ago, was right on the money, that people who are smacking their heads in incredulousness at this guy's imbecility are completely missing the point, because he has political savvy. He had it in 1988 when he played a crucial role in his father's campaign against Michael Dukakis. George W. Bush was deeply involved in the Willie Horton business. He was deeply involved in the decision to counterattack Dan Rather on the CBS Evening News. The fact is that George W. Bush does have sufficient political skill to appeal to his base.
All right. Well, I agree with that, Mark. And now I think we're getting somewhere. Because that tension that I was describing is now being sort of resolved, if you will, in favor of a certain degree of political savvy. Now, let's address the connection between the political savvy and the intellectual capability. Now, what I've seen out of this White House is a very disciplined and focused effort to get its agenda across and accomplished. And I think that it is now apparent in retrospect that was very much the focus on of the campaign. There was a lot of repetitive quality to this. One had the sense at various times during the campaign that one was being talked down to by the Bush campaign. The themes, the language to which Bush kept retreating and going back, you know, from the point of view of you know, a couple people who spend their time, you know, writing books or articles and thinking about things. This is boring and possibly even hypnotizing or apparently hypnotizing in its effect. But from the point of view of the candidate, that may just be something that goes now by the name of message discipline and the effort to get to people. The idea that the electorate is not listening all that carefully and is only listening for a very short time.
And all this contrasts very favorably with the mess that Bill Clinton made of his first 6 months, with the endless meetings, with the, on the one hand, on the other hand, the lack of management. Bush is running a very tight ship. I mean, it's not for nothing that he went to the Harvard Business School. Dave is calling from Tupper Lake, New York. Hello.
Yeah, hi. How you doing? I just read the Bush the Sexicon. I finished about a week ago. During the whole chat thing or something, I was overseas. I wasn't even in America. I just got back a month ago. And everyone's telling me these chads and everything else. I had no idea what they were talking about because I was in Shanghai and the information was very limited over there. But what I wanted to comment on was how Bush supporters apparently view Bush. I have spoke with many before and after long before the election and then after. And people who support Bush seem to say, oh, I just love him. I really love him. He's a great guy. And I ask, well, can you give me some specifics? And they would just say, I don't know. I just love him. Or they'd say he was good in education. And I would say something like, well, what did he do good in education mm-hmm. in Texas? And there's never a clear answer. And it would just end up, unfortunately, an attack on Gore. And I am not a Gore fan either by any stretch. I'm not, a partisan Democrat by any stretch. But I was just really baffled at the absolute lack of information people could provide for their undying support of Bush.
Yeah, and a lot of it had to do, as you say, with the other guy he was running against, who put people off from coast to coast. Mark Miller,
that's
what about that? We're leaving Gore out of this. You didn't have to be a fool to vote for George W. Bush, did you?
No, you didn't. And I'm glad, I'm grateful for Dave's call because that will help us contextualize all of this. There is no George W. Bush as president without Bill Clinton as the previous president. George W. Bush would not be in the White House if it were not for the long anti-Clinton jihad of the previous 8 years. They are completely and inseparably involved with one another. I have found since I began to talk about this book, Coast to Coast, that when people call up to assail me and attack me and to defend Bush, they invariably invoke Bill Clinton as a counter mm-hmm. example. Mm-hmm. I've never in my life ever noticed anything quite like this, where a sitting president is defended on the grounds that he is not his predecessor. I mean, in the past, people have tended to salute presidents for being able to do something that their predecessor couldn't do. Mm-hmm. But in this case, it's that Bush is simply not Clinton. He is the un-Clinton. And I think that the Republicans have done a masterful job at inflating the Clinton bogey. Mm-hmm. And the press has done a disgraceful job in its tendency to fall for this time and time again. A lot of Bush's free ride over the first 6 months of his presidency had a great deal to do with the huge and endless flap over the pardon of Mark Rich.
Right.
Which most of your listeners probably don't know this, but the federal attorney in New York the other day found that Clinton had violated no laws in that whole episode.
But it was heaven sent for George Bush. Todd Lindbergh,
absolutely.
Why don't you come in on this?
Yeah, I'd be glad to. The pardon problem was not a Republican-created thing. The people who were most upset with Clinton over the pardons were Democrats. You should have read the editorials in the Washington Post, and for that matter, in the New York Times.
Oh, sure.
They
sure.
were very harsh. So
sure,
the idea of that is certainly it worked to Bush's advantage.
But,
by the way, there is a time-honored tradition in politics, which is, when your enemy is doing himself in, you let him get on with it. He doesn't get out of the way.
Give him more rope. Yeah. You know, and you can even read Bush as the anti-Clinton in another way, that his stumblings are a sort of manifest of authenticity. He's not trying to parse what is. And in that strange way, I think the syntactical confusions are sort of communicate to the voters, well, this guy is not Bill Clinton. He is not he is not a Sharpie. He couldn't be a Sharpie and talk like that. And then I really think that gave a kind of message, don't you, Mark?
Oh, absolutely. You're right on the money with that. But let's be realistic for a moment. We're talking about this whole thing sheerly on the basis of style, of theatricality, of various cosmetic features of this or that candidate. So Clinton became infamous for quibbling about the meaning of the word is. Bush stumbles often when he speaks. Ergo, we're supposed to conclude,
right,
this must mean that Bush is he's one of us and Clinton was not. Now, I'm not going to take Clinton's side. I'm not a Democrat, just like Dave. I'm an independent. And I voted for Ralph Nader in the last election. Nevertheless, I think we have to pay attention to the fact that Clinton's problems gave Bush a tremendous amount of cover, which has enabled Bush to pose as something he's not, which is to say, one of the people. Now, let me give you a specific example of where the media has failed radically at protecting the interests of Americans. Early in the Bush presidency, Paul O'Neill gave an interview to the Financial Times in which he said quite openly that he was interested in seeing the elimination of the corporate income tax and, while they're at it, the elimination of Social Security and Medicare. The Financial Times asked him if he was alone in the Bush administration in this view, and he said no, that these ideas got a very warm hearing from many of his colleagues in the Bush cabinet. There was no coverage of this at all.
Sure.
None. Now, maybe the Mark Rich pardon was a big deal, all right? Maybe the Clintons having taken a dinette set out of the White House is a big deal. But I tend to be somewhat conservative myself in these matters, and I would say that a radical proposal like the elimination of those huge entitlements certainly deserves discussion, whether you're for it or against it.
It's
newsworthy, but there is nothing about it.
And this gets us back to the press, to the media, and we want to talk about that more, that side of the Bush, sort of the collaboration, Bush and his condition, and the role that the press played in making him our president and making him a credible president today. You're listening to The Connection on NPR. We're at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. And we say goodbye now to Todd Lindbergh. Thank you for being with us.
Sure.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR News Station. Coming up in the
connection, my guest this hour is Mark Crispin Miller, author of The Bush Dyslexicon, Observations on a National Disorder. 1-800-423-8255 is the number to call, 1-800-423-TALK, to join the conversation. Tim is on the line from Granby, Connecticut. Hello.
Good morning, Jack.
Good morning.
Great show. And Mark, I can't wait to read your book.
Oh, good.
Just a couple of comments that I've heard this morning. Someone made the comment about Bush is running a tight ship. I firmly believe that Bush is really nothing more than the spokesman for this team, really headed up by, I think, Karl Rove and certainly Dick Cheney and some others who are really, really running the show. I mean, he's a spokesperson. He's a front guy. And I think that the strategy of this team is to put him on the front and allow him to make a fool of himself periodically. And I think it's intended to do just that. And I think it goes back to playing into the media's hands from the perspective that a lot of interviews that I saw, you know, back in the fall before the election, as to, you know, why people like Bush and why they were going to vote for Bush, and especially on the male side, when I heard a lot of men say around the country that they liked him because he was the type of guy they could go out and have a beer with. They really connected with this guy from that perspective. Well, I don't know. I think that the media picked up on that and said, you know, maybe this guy's okay. You know, we're gonna kind of back off. And I think it parlays into, I think, what's going on in the major media in this country, which is really not a liberal-controlled media or a liberal-slanted media, it's a conservative media. And I think it's opposite what Rush Limbaugh and some of the other folks out there say. And I think it's I think we've got to take a look at that and realize it for what it is.
Well, Mark does take a look at it. Mark Miller, and we need to be a little brief just because we're up against it.
Okay.
Huge subject to be brief about, but there you
well,
are.
Well, it is huge. Well, I'll simply
the
say.
The liberal media, a myth?
The liberal media, a complete myth. Well, a propaganda fabrication. Mm-hmm. This is absolutely false. There is no evidence for this claim. There is only abundant counter-evidence to the contrary. And I go through this in some detail in the Bush Dyslexicon, which I really urge anyone who thinks there's a liberal media to read, because if you are rational, you have to grant that the media's behavior really throughout the last 20 years, but particularly lately and up to the present, with its relentless coverage of the Gary Condit affair, even as the Bush team promotes a far-right agenda, with its absolute refusal to talk about what happened in Florida, because we did have a stolen election in this country, and there is mounting evidence to that effect.
Well, of course, we do. We have had the New York Times weighing in on that at great length and illuminatingly on the subject, haven't we? I mean, it hasn't been totally ignored. It's just the TV
Well, that's just it, Jack. Yeah. That's just it. That was a late but welcome and superb piece of investigative journalism in the best tradition, the stuff about the overseas absentee ballots. And it had no traction on TV. None of the Solons of the airwaves would even bring it up. Tim Russert, Chris Matthews, this is yesterday's papers. This is old business, you know.
Yes.
That doesn't seem to me to bespeak a liberal media establishment.
And in fact, these people go to work every day and they say to themselves, I am not going to betray a liberal bias here because this immense machine will fall on me and cost me my job.
Right.
The one thing anybody in the media doesn't want to do is to see quote-unquote liberal.
Liberal, right.
Kalyani is calling from Stowe, Mass.
Yes, hi. Hello?
Hello.
Do you hear me?
We do.
Yes. Okay, I'm a learning disability specialist, and I really wanted to speak to that angle. And ever since there was this allusion to Bush's undiagnosed dyslexia, it's been a bit of a joke among my circles. And, you know, just watching him blunder along, and hearing him repeatedly say that research in various areas isn't solid, doesn't hold up, and knowing what dyslexia really looks like, I'm, you know, partly tongue-in-cheek and partly in reality a bit concerned for our national security, having a chief executive who can't read, let alone speak.
So you think he does have dyslexia?
I have no idea what he has, but if they're claiming that he has dyslexia, I think he owes it to the nation to go out, get a diagnosis, work with somebody, and learn how to read and learn how to talk. I mean, that's such a loser excuse.
Sure, but people with dyslexia manage to function all the time and make great contributions to our society.
That's the other point I want to make. People with dyslexia are very competent, and he's bringing a bad name to my dyslexic students. I have 14-year-olds who struggle with much more than he does, who are very competent because they get the help they need,
right.
They're up front, they work
right.
tremendously hard, and one of them would make a far more competent president than Bush does. And my other point is, you know, so if he does have a learning disability, whether it's diagnosed or not, I'm sure he's aware of the fact that he mangles things. Why can't he preview a speech? Why can't one of his people who help him run a tight ship, quote-unquote, get up there with him and rehearse the names that he has to speak in the speech? Why does it have such low priority with him?
Yeah, of course, it's not the speeches that he's had trouble with so much as the off the cuff remarks.
Yes.
But your point is well taken.
Yes,
and
he has mispronounced foreign dignitaries' names.
Of course, and so would we all, frankly. Mark, what about that? I mean, he never denied. In fact, he said straight out about the Vanity Fair piece by Gail Sheehy. I believe his words were, "That woman who knew I was dyslexic, I didn't interview her." He gave
right.
a dyslexic answer to the question.
He gave a dyslexic denial of the charge that he was dyslexic, and that's what everybody focused on at the time he made the statement. But it is more significant, I argue, in the Bush Dyslexicon because of the first clause in that reply, that woman who knew I
yeah.
had dyslexia.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't say the woman who claimed I
yeah.
had dyslexia.
This is, again, the self-revealing Bush.
Exactly. But see, I think the larger issue here isn't dyslexia per se, because I point out in the book, Thomas Edison, Albert Einstein, a lot of really
sure.
formidable intellects have
Indeed.
Been dyslexic. The issue is whether Bush is forthcoming about his own condition. Mm-hmm. And that extends not just to dyslexia, but to drinking. There is evidence on the public record that I adduce in the Bush dyslexicon that he did continue to drink past that famous 40th birthday vow of his to stop cold turkey, where he tells everybody that he just decided one day in 1986 that he'd had enough, and by gum, he just stopped.
Yeah.
But there are a couple of very telling episodes, one from 1987 and one from 1992, which suggest, to the contrary,
yeah,
he didn't stop. And since this is a high-stress job that he's holding, you would think that the media
would go into
the liberals of the media would bring this up and, yeah, at least try to, you know, get him to rectify,
sure,
his story.
Sure.
But they don't bother.
Brian is on the line. Hello.
How's it going?
Hello.
Hello.
Welcome.
How's it going? Thank you. I wanted to make a couple quick points. First off, it's amazing that we're talking about a world leader in this context. You know what I'm saying? It's amazing that we're talking about like the basic skill competencies of a world leader, somebody who's, you know, responsible for many things that influence everybody in the world. And I personally, I agree. I think he's, you know, for lack of a better word, I think he's a buffoon. But it amazes me that he has managed to capitalize on the kind of the apathy of this country and pull it into his court politically just by playing, you know, the simple normal guy. You know, he's the mask that the devil's wearing right now in the world, and it's
you're talking now like one of his core supporters, the devil wear in the world.
Yeah, exactly. Basically, the way I look at it is, I'd rather have a president in office who's getting an oral sex from an intern than one who's sodomizing democracy.
Oh my gosh! Well,
so,
that's a
whoa
this,
line.
You go over the top on that one, Robert.
Yeah,
thank you.
Sure.
Thank you very much.
All right.
Well, I
Brian.
Will say Brian's point prompts me to say this, Jack. There's been a kind of undercurrent throughout this whole hour of resignation on the part of people who do not support Bush. I think it's very important for your listeners, or at least those who feel that way, to bear in mind that it was not a majority that voted for this guy.
Sure.
It was a minority. Some 52% of those who voted, or those who managed to vote, voted either Democratic or Green. Another percentage point voted for Buchanan. This means that George W. Bush did not receive anything like a mandate.
Right.
Moreover, there is, as I said a moment ago, mounting evidence that this election was simply stolen.
Right.
What this means is that it's really well past time for us to get beyond sitting and simply marveling at the fact,
right,
that someone like this is in the White House. The Democrats have got to do their job.
Sure.
And get themselves into the war mind that the Republicans have been in for quite some time.
Let's hear from a Bush supporter. Robert is calling from Long Lake, New York. Hello.
Hi there. Can you hear me?
We can, loud,
yes,
and clear.
I would like to speak on a public broadcast station. I am so far to the right, I think of Attila the Hun as a pinko. And this man is really saying a lot of things, but he doesn't seem to back him up with facts. And I want to bring these to you. In the New York Times some while ago, they indicated the intelligence, according to the application of the college that they had, was 138 for Gore and 136 for George Walker. That doesn't make either of them exceptionally brilliant, makes them nice, smart people, and equal. The other thing is, the man is talking about the English. I know very bright people, and especially guys in the Air Force, as this guy, Walker, G. Walker, is a pilot, you know, and he went through the training. He must have very good eyesight. And good eyesight sometimes is not good reading sight, and they tend to make these errors like he is making now. The other thing is, to the man who is condemning him here, I never heard the word averageness. Average is sort of a ness right in itself. In the other words, incredulousness is better used as incredulity.
Wow.
And, you know, you're talking the language. Every one of us have little flaws.
You're absolutely right about that. And
when we make those flaws, it's like the Bible says, condemn the beam and the mote in somebody's eyes for the beam in your own. I think criticism shows in this gentleman's case a caste jealousy. I know the arrogance of Ivy League graduates, and it's incredible.
Well, of course, Bush is one himself. We have
I know,
to
that's
out.
What I'm talking about there. I had a brother went to Princeton. My God, what a ruination of a man.
He still hasn't recovered. Mark Miller?
Nobody ever will.
I don't know
that's
what to
my
say.
Comments. I don't know if there's an answer or rebuttal, but I wanted to make him as a loyal and card-carrying...
You're proud
of
Bush.
...a Hun, a right-winger,
yeah.
to a... The really leftist
well,
public
you know,
broadcast.
Well, thank you for your call. Thank you, for,
thank
your
you
call.
For having me.
Well, we're delighted.
It shows an openness which goes back to the old days of journalism when they took all points and tried to be objective.
Well, we want to do that.
That was taught in the when Prince Columbia was a great journalist at school in the 30s. And the thing they taught was not only the five W's, but also complete objectivity in reporting.
It's very difficult, of course, because we're human beings. We filter everything through our own minds and biographies and sensibilities. But I do think the media tries. What about this objectivity, Mark?
Well, there really is no such thing as objectivity. I think it is, however, as Robert suggests, important that news organizations try at least to remain open to other points of view. Well, we have a kind of cult of objectivity, or I should say a mystique of objectivity in American journalism. We have had for about a century. And what it has tended to do has been to mask very strong bias with an apparent impartiality that is, in a way, more dangerous than any kind of openly partisan slant, if you see what I mean. Very often... You will assume, for example, that what's on the network news is simply objective, or what we read in the Washington Post or the New York Times is simply objective.
Mark, I've got to be objective. It's been great having you on the show. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thanks to my guests, Mark Crispin Miller, the author of The Bush Dyslexicon, Observations on a National Disorder. And we spoke earlier with Todd Lindberg, former editorial page editor of The Washington Times. Connection listeners, you can continue the conversation on our website at www.theconnection.org. I'm Jack Beatty. This is The Connection.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the League of New Hampshire Craftsmen Fair, August 4th.